This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, enrollment may not be over. Some reprieve is on the way for Americans who failed to sign up for health coverage before the February 15th close of open enrollment.
Well, that's right, Mark. The administration announced a plan that would allow those who had not signed up for coverage to do so.
Then a tax penalty is automatically assessed on folks who remained uninsured by February 15th.
And people will have to attest that they first became aware of the tax penalty while they were preparing their taxes. They'll still have to pay the penalty for remaining uninsured last year, but by gaining coverage this year, they'll avoid most of the penalty for remaining uninsured in 2015.
This is an extended open enrollment that really only applies to folks living in the 37 states that rely on the federal exchange. However, states that set up their own exchanges can opt to extend their enrollment as well.
And while the health law's fine print is continuing to be worked out, we turn our attention to the myriad developers who are transforming care on the side of healthcare and technology. Our guest today is Dr. Yulin Wong, who's the founder of InTouch Health, and he's also the president of the American Telemedicine Association.
He has over 50 patents to his name, including the first FDA-approved surgical robot, the ASOP. He's since turned his attention to developing platforms for clinicians to do virtual visits, his so-called robot doc. Should be quite interesting.
Absolutely. And Laurie Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, will join us with yet another misstatement spoken about health policy in the public domain. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Yulin Wong in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A number of states are weighing in on the decision by the Department of Health and Human Services allowing extended open enrollment for the second round of insurance sign-ups under the Affordable Care Act. The administration announced folks in the 37 states covered by the federal exchange will be able to still enroll for coverage for 2015, even though open enrollment ended February 15th. There's now a new extended period from March 15th to April 30th to gain coverage, thus helping folks avoid tax penalties for their 2015 tax year. Now, states like Kentucky, who launched their own state exchanges, are considering allowing the same. Meanwhile, as the Supreme Court weighs in on whether language in the Affordable Care Act precludes folks buying insurance on the federal exchange, qualifying for tax subsidies, the language originally stated folks only buying on the state exchanges would qualify. There's no real plan B from opponents of the health care law should the High Court repeal the basis for those subsidies. But 87% of Americans who've purchased insurance on the exchanges receive some sort of tax subsidy. Millions of Americans would lose coverage if the Supreme Court rules against upholding them. And the administration is also weighing in on employee insurance plans that don't cover hospital stays. Corporations employing largely low-wage workers who now must be covered under the health law were selling employees on cheap plans that offered no hospital benefits. The administration saying these plans clearly don't fulfill the minimum requirements under the health law and would not be allowed, as they would strap employees in substandard plans that would not cover catastrophic care. Turns out there may be some actual wisdom in those teeth, after all. Study finds stem cells found in the dental pulp of wisdom teeth are perfect incubators for growing corneal cells. Researchers found the pulp cells could be coaxed into growing autologous corneas to help repair scarring from things like infection or other eye diseases. And pediatric allergies have been on the rise in recent decades, and researchers in Sweden may have found a contributing culprit. Babies raised in houses where dishes were cleaned in dishwashers versus by hand had 50% higher rates of allergies, eczema, and other autoimmune responses. Researchers believe it has to do with a growing trend, hygiene hypothesis, which assumes babies being raised in developed countries are growing up too clean with sanitizers that limit normal childhood exposure to bacteria and pathogens, thus inhibiting their natural immune system development. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
A We're speaking today with Yulin Wong, a PhD chairman and CEO of InTouch Health, a global leader in telehealth technologies and support. Dr. Wong is also president-elect of the American Telemedicine Association, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the full integration of telemedicine into healthcare systems. Mr. Wong is founder of Computer Motion, Inc., which developed ASOP, the first FDA-cleared surgical robot. Mr. Wong has more than 100 patents to his name. He received his PhD in electrical engineering, specializing in robotics from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Wong, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, you've really been at the cutting edge of innovation in the healthcare space, having created this first surgical robot approved by the FDA for use in the country, ASOP. I wonder if you could share with our listeners what you've learned from your early experiences and successes with health technology as we look at this vast amount of technological innovations in healthcare today and the changes that are abounding.
Well, if we go all the way back to ESOP, it was in the early 1990s. What we did was solve an unmet need in a newly emerging field of surgery called minimally invasive surgery, or more specifically laparoscopic surgery, through little tiny incisions as opposed to large incisions, which had previously been the way surgeons worked. And by using little incisions, they needed to insert a camera into the patient's body that needed to be held by something or somebody, and having someone else hold your camera was like someone else holding your eyes. And so building a robotic arm which held the camera for the surgeon, which was voice controlled directly by the surgeon, we actually gave the surgeon back direct control of their eyes, which then improved the quality of the procedure. The whole idea, which has been, you know, kind of a guiding principle to my career over the last 25 years, is trying to solve a problem which is a problem for the user, a problem for the healthcare system as a whole, and then a problem which hopefully really brings benefit to society. So you have to kind of overlap all of these requirements simultaneously.
Well, Dr. Wong, maybe for the benefit of our listeners, you could talk a little bit about how these the robotic innovation in particularly, and again, I think it's a metaphor for lots of other innovations, has changed the way we train people, has ushered in a new generation of surgeons. And do you have any metrics that illustrate the impact that the robotic technology in particular has had on care, cost, and outcomes?
So I've been involved in basically two different movements. One is on the surgical robot side, and the second is on the telemedicine robot side. And on the surgical robot side, where the whole idea of these surgical robots is to enable more complex surgeries to be done minimally invasively, when you take a particular procedure from an open procedure to a minimally invasive procedure using a robot, there's a whole learning curve. So take the one which really took off for robotic surgical systems, which is the removal of the prostate for men's prostate cancer. And so the training process of that had to be done very, very carefully, where there's a whole process of didactics, laboratory setting, a process of mentorship. Again, it's the surgeon learning a new procedure, but then having the benefit and the tool of a robotic surgical system, because without the robotic tool, that transformation was actually not even possible. On the telemedicine side, using what we call remote presence robots, where we're bringing a physician to the bedside of a patient from afar, the actual usage of the technology is actually quite easy. They can learn how to use the tools in a matter of, you know, minutes or tens of minutes. But what has to happen is the whole workflow, the way a physician adjusts his or her workflow in terms of how they go about their day, changes. And in fact, the healthcare system, which is now deploying telemedicine, they have to rethink about how they're going to be interacting with their patients, in what venue, and what is the workflow in order to do that. So for example, one of the areas where we've done a lot of work is in telestroke. The patient comes into the hospital, which is perhaps a smaller hospital, doesn't have immediate access to a stroke neurologist. Now they page a stroke neurologist at a tertiary hospital or a larger hospital who can beam in through a telemedicine robot to help take care of that patient, that's a whole workflow which did not exist. How the tertiary physician or subspecialist interacts with the on-site physicians all have to be kind of rethought and retooled so that people in a collaborative way know how to approach the whole system of care.
So certainly we're seeing people using their smartphone, connecting with a provider, and these are, I think you've described them as not replacing the physician or the provider, but extenders. So what else are you sort of seeing distant capabilities and diagnostic tools that I might carry on my iPhone, and how's that world evolving?
Well, the world is evolving very quickly, and I'll tell you, it's an incredibly exciting place to be, where we're going from kind of a cottage industry of healthcare delivery to where your local doc is the total range of healthcare services available to you as a patient. That's changing, where using a healthcare delivery system where virtualized care, in other words, you have the capabilities of the world at large at your disposal, is the way things are happening. So you've got this aging population, mm-hmm. that's happening in the U.S. and around the world. You've got a continuing increasing of complexity of medicine. Turns out there's about 200,000 medical journal articles published a year. It turns out in 1970 there were about 10 different medical subspecialties. Today there are 150 endovascular neurosurgeons, neurological intensivists. These types of subspecialties didn't even exist 10 years ago. If you were a patient, you'd want access to the best subspecialty that you could have. So unevenly distributed quality of care, and yet we want to deliver high quality care consistently and lowering the cost. Now the question is, how do we do that? And it's really through this kind of virtualized delivery of care that can happen. One huge movement which allows this evolution, one is the mobile devices. So everybody's carrying around. The second one, which the mobile devices build on top, is the internet, where live interactions, real-time interactions can be done all over the world now because the bandwidth and quality of the internet is now there. And then furthermore, the electronic digitization of healthcare information. So you can actually virtualize the delivery of care. And I think this, over the next decade, it's going to completely revolutionize how healthcare delivery happens.
Well, the pace of innovation has been breathtaking in this area of virtualization of care and telehealth, telemedicine. And so I'm going to put innovation and speed and revolution on one side, and then the concrete wall that they sometimes smack up against called regulation and coverage, which can really slow down how we get these incredible innovations into the hands and the care of people who need it. So how is this going on the regulatory front? I know we talked to the FDA about what apps should be regulated versus not regulated a while ago. How are those developments coming?
Well, so you hit upon one, which we deal with all the time, the FDA. And the FDA, their mandate around regulating medical devices is consistent and will stay, I think, the way it's been for the last many decades. So when you build a medical device as dictated by the FDA, then it needs to be regulated. For example, a stethoscope is a medical device. If you turn an iPhone into a stethoscope, it's a medical device and needs to be appropriately dealt with from a regulatory standpoint. And it's actually not that difficult in terms of understanding that line. The other big area of regulation is HIPAA compliance in terms of privacy and protection for patient information. And that bar is continually getting tighter and more rigorous, quite honestly, as it should, because I think the concerns about hacking and cybersecurity are also continually going up, not only in healthcare, but across our society as a whole. The other area which is important, too, is the whole areas of when can you practice telemedicine and how is it legal to practice
right.
it. And these are like things around licensure,
right.
credentialing, privileging. And this area is actually kind of messy and quite honestly is probably going to stay messy. But this is, so my role, I'm actually the current president of the ATA, American Telemedicine Association, and the ATA is really kind of the leading organization to drive clarity and hopefully improvement in these areas of credentialing, licensing, privileging. And that's, you know, that's at the state level, and there's state laws involved in addition to federal laws. And that's going to move at whatever pace it continues to move. But in general, the legal environment is moving in the direction supportive of more and more telemedicine kind of interactions.
We're speaking today with Yulin Wong, PhD, Chairman and CEO of InTouch Health, a global leader in telehealth technologies and support. Dr. Wong is current president of the American Telemedicine Association, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the full integration of telemedicine into the healthcare system around the world. Yulin, why don't delve a little more into the work of the American Telemedicine Association. It sounded like your focus had both state issues, federal issues, regulatory issues. Tell us a little bit about the association.
Yeah, the American Telemedicine Association is based in Washington, D.C. It's been in existence since 1993, so it's a little over 20 years old. It is the largest and longest standing association in this field when telemedicine, quite honestly, has become in vogue. It's in existence for several reasons, and one is to actually drive improvement from our regulatory environment that we've actually been talking about. It provides a forum by which people meet and discuss the issues around telemedicine. And in fact, the annual meeting is coming up in May this year in Los Angeles, where there's something like 500 presentations. There's also a large exhibit floor of 250-plus different companies. So if someone wants to really learn about telemedicine quickly, that's really the best place to go. It builds standards and guidelines on how to perform telemedicine safely and effectively for various applications. And then as some of these new methodologies of telemedicine are being push forward, like direct-to-consumer telemedicine interactions where a patient from perhaps their workplace is interacting with the primary care physician via a telemedicine interaction, there's a new type of accreditation process where companies offering this type of service are being accredited by the ATA in order to make sure that they comply with, you know, best practices.
Mm-hmm. We also try and keep a global perspective, and can you tell us for a moment what you think the potential global health impact of these technologies are?
I think the opportunity for telemedicine in the global world is huge, and perhaps even much more profound in some of these other markets than it is even is in the United States. Because in the United States, I think telemedicine is being driven not only to work on improving the quality of care, but really working hard to reduce cost of the delivery system. In much of the emerging markets, people don't even have access to care. And so using telemedicine is the only way they even have access to care. And so, for example, I was in a talk with one of our own people who were walking our company through a story within the last couple of weeks in Bolivia, where they brought in an expert from Canada to help take care of a patient in the Bolivian Andes who's had this genetic problem, which nobody's been able to diagnose in Bolivia for his whole life. And so it was properly diagnosed from a Canadian subspecialist. I mean, it's a life-changing thing for that child and the town at large. It was a town of like 1,500 people in the Bolivian Andes. And so these are the types of things which are possible with telemedicine in the world at large, where there's just a large, large number of people who don't even have access to care. And this can solve that problem.
We've been speaking today with Yulin Wong, PhD, Chairman and CEO of InTouch Health, a global leader in telehealth technologies and support. You can learn more about his work by going to intouchhealth.com or AmericanTelemed.org. Yulin, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's a real pleasure, and thanks for bringing me on your show.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Barack Obama says the Affordable Care Act is working, quote, a little bit better than we anticipated. Based on the 11.4 million people who signed up for insurance on the exchanges during the recent open enrollment period. That is better than the administration anticipated, but worse than a Congressional Budget Office projection. The administration's preliminary estimates are that 11.4 million either signed up for or re-enrolled in private marketplace plans during that period. Obama says in a White House video that that's great news and the Affordable Care Act is working a little bit better than we anticipated. The Department of Health and Human Services told reporters in November, just before open enrollment began, that it anticipated enrollment would be between 10.3 million and 11.2 million. So 11.4 million is a little bit better than that. But an HHS analysis said the figure would end up being lower by year's end as some people wouldn't pay premiums or would take other insurance. The analysis estimated that between 9 million and 9.9 million would be the total for marketplace enrollment in 2015. The administration's November analysis moved the goalpost, saying it would take longer than CBO estimated for marketplace enrollment to grow. The CBO expects a major expansion of enrollment in the near future, jumping to 21 million people in 2016 and then 25 million in 2017. HHS said that kind of growth could happen over 4 or 5 years instead. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Leanne Brown was a graduate student in nutritional science at NYU, she came to understand the enormous challenges of eating healthy foods while doing field work with some of New York City's more impoverished populations. And when it came time to do her thesis, she thought, why not write a cookbook of health recipes aimed at the millions of Americans living on food stamps or SNAP stipends of $4 a day?
$4 a day is sort of the general rule of thumb for around how much a person who is qualifying for food stamps would have to eat per day. So we felt like that was a more useful sort of explanation, sort of explains like a budget range.
She learned that while poverty was a serious issue, the lack of access to nutritious food was also contributing to obesity and poor health in many of these families. So she conducted extensive research on shopping and healthy cooking techniques and crafted Good and Cheap, a cookbook aimed at not only teaching these families how to shop for affordable produce, but how to get an entire family to cook in a more healthy way.
I really wanted to arm people with the ability to walk into a grocery store and say, like, okay, this is on sale. I can totally make something delicious out of that. I know how to do that. In order to really get by on such a small amount of money, you need to be able to be adaptable.
Her thesis was so well received, she launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise enough money to make the book available at soup kitchens, women's shelters, and community health centers. And for every copy she sells, she gives one free copy to a school, a health center, or organization that requested.
The idea is that this is a cookbook that needs to be put into the hands of someone who really can't afford the cookbook. So that's where the idea of doing the buy one, give one came from, was sort of like there are people out there who are really excited about this issue and have money to spend on it and who can appreciate that if they can sort of help to subsidize those who can't.
Well, a new version of her book comes out in June. She's made her book available as a free PDF download to anyone who wants it. Good and Cheap, a cookbook aimed at the food stamp population or anyone else on fixed income for that matter, helping to positively influence their diets, obesity, and well-being. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.